KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
American citizens are the only ones who can vote. They're the only ones who can serve on juries, and they have an automatic right to live in this country.
President Trump proposes the idea of sending U.S. citizens to prisons in El Salvador, but many legal experts say that is unconstitutional.
It is Wednesday, April 16th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, Britain's top court defines a woman as someone who's born biologically female.
How will this ruling affect transgender rights?
What this ruling suggests is we're not welcome, we're not wanted, and we can now be excluded from UK society at a moment's notice.
Also, an archaeological dig reveals evidence of a West African kingdom from centuries ago.
That's what European powers use, that void, to encroach upon the territory and start controlling things.
And new data from the CDC shows that autism is on the rise, but the cause is up for debate.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A U.S. senator from Maryland is working from El Salvador for the release of a man mistakenly deported to that country. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports Senator Chris Van Hollen said Salvadoran officials refused his request to release the Maryland man.
Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Maryland Democrat, said the Salvadoran vice president also refused his request to visit with Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. Regardless, Van Hollen said more U.S. officials will travel to fight for his release.
I may be the first United States senator to visit El Salvador on this issue, but there will be more, and there will be more members of Congress coming.
Van Hollen argued against the administration's claims that Abrego Garcia has ties to gang activity. He was granted protection from deportation by a judge in 2019. The administration admitted in legal proceedings the deportation was a mistake, but have since refused a Supreme Court decision upholding an order they must facilitate the man's return. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
A U.S. District Court judge says he has found probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt of court and says he could seek to prosecute officials. That's for violating his orders last month to turn around planes carrying deportees to a prison in El Salvador. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg's decision marking an escalation in the battle between the judicial and executive branches of government over presidential power. More than 20 tribes and nonprofits across the U.S. were awarded about $350 million to address critical infrastructure needs, but the Trump administration has now frozen those funds. NPR's Nate Perez has more.
The money came from the EPA's community change grants, funded through the country's first significant climate policy, the Inflation Reduction Act. The Tabona Foundation received $20 million to replace homes contaminated with asbestos and lead for the native village of Tyonik in Alaska. The foundation's executive director, Vidi Croto, says that money would have changed people's lives.
Everything is in limbo, and the bills still come in, you know, the rent still comes in.
Now dozens of tribes don't know if or when they will have funds that were awarded to them under the Biden administration. The EPA spokesperson Molly Vassalou says that community change grants are under review to see how they align with the administration's priorities. Nate Perez, NPR News.
Consumers were spending last month, in some cases actually boosting spending a bit to get ahead of Trump administration tariffs. Government reports retail sales rose by a stronger than expected 1.4% last month after a smaller rise the previous month. However, much of last month's rise was attributable to increased car sales ahead of the Trump tariffs. On Wall Street, stocks moved sharply lower, the Dow down 699 points. This is NPR. The Trump administration now says it is suing Maine's education department for not complying with its push to ban transgender athletes for participating in women's sports. The lawsuit announced by Attorney General Pam Bondi escalates a dispute over whether Maine is abiding by a federal law barring discrimination based on sex. Maine's Democratic Governor Janet Mills previously told President Trump, quote, "We'll see you in court." The United Nations Humanitarian Response Arm says it's planning to cut its workforce by 20% due to funding shortages, NPR's Fatma Tanis reports.
The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, also known as OCHA, is facing a funding gap of $60 million. In a note to staff, the head of OCHA, Tom Fletcher, said the organization would have to regroup and cut a fifth of its overall workforce. OCHA will also scale back its operations in several countries, including Colombia, Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Zimbabwe. Fletcher said OCHA was facing its toughest ever moment with the humanitarian community, quote, underfunded, overstretched, and literally under attack. Vital life-saving work is ending, Fletcher said. These cuts come in the wake of the Trump administration's dismantling of U.S. foreign aid. Other countries around the world have also pulled back from humanitarian funding. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Representative Lee Stefanik, who is a one-time nominee to the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, now says she's mulling a run for the New York governor's office. Stefanik is a close ally of President Trump's, but her nomination was pulled last month amid concerns about leaving a Republican House seat vacant. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Trump administration's move to send immigrants to a maximum security prison in El Salvador is the subject of multiple ongoing fights in court. But in an Oval Office meeting with the Salvadoran president this week, President Trump was already looking ahead.
We also have homegrown criminals that push people into subways that hit elderly ladies on the back of the head with a baseball bat when they're not looking, that are absolute monsters. I'd like to include them in the group of people to get them out of the country.
Trump later clarified that by homegrown criminals, he meant U.S. citizens. And he said his attorney general is looking into the legality of getting them out of the country.
We're studying the laws right now. Pam is studying. If we can do that, that's good.
Matt Ford has been studying them, too. He covers the courts for the New Republic magazine and has a new piece looking for historical and legal precedents for what Trump is proposing. Matt Ford, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the headline for your piece, which reads, Trump's wildly unconstitutional plot to banish U.S. citizens to gulags. Wildly unconstitutional?
Well, when we speak of things that are constitutional and unconstitutional, it's not always a bright line. Some of the parts of the Constitution are up for interpretation. What is cruel and unusual punishment? What is due process? What is a reasonable search and seizure? Banishment and exile, on the other hand, there really is no basis for that in the Constitution or in any federal law.
As you reported this out, as you called around to various legal experts, you found no one who could see any basis for this in the Constitution?
Well, it's tough because, on one hand, the courts have never really ruled on it. That's what makes it so striking. And
because nobody's tried it.
Nobody's done it. And so, I can't find a Supreme Court opinion. I can't point one to you and cite you one where the justices 50 or 100 years ago said banishment is unconstitutional, exile is unconstitutional. But when you look at the grand scope of how the courts think about deportation, extradition, citizenship, it's pretty clear that it would be a disfavored practice. And we know that also from American history.
I want to play one other moment from that Oval Office meeting. This is when President Trump is asked explicitly if he's talking about U.S. citizens.
Yeah, that includes them. What, do you think there's special category of person? They're as bad as anybody that comes in. We have bad ones, too.
Matt Ford, are U.S. citizens a special category of person under U.S. law?
Constitutionally speaking, in many ways, they are. I mean, American citizens are the only ones who can vote. They're the only ones who can serve on juries, and they have a automatic right to live in this country. The general practice is they can't be denied reentry if they leave. which is sort of a constitutional barrier in and of itself to the idea that they would be exiled to a distant land.
Yeah. There are ways that a U.S. government can legally remove people from the country. There's deportation that applies to non-citizens. Mm-hmm. Extradition.
Yeah, extradition stands out to me as the one truly legal pathway that this could happen. It's very rare, but it does happen. Basically, the premise is the United States signs a treaty with another country. That sets up the framework. Courts then say, you know, you can't deport an American citizen unless there's an explicit requirement in the treaty to do that. The other state has to match U.S. levels of due process, basic rights. So you can't simply send someone to North Korea. I think those would be an impediment against anything Trump is planning for El Salvador, partly because El Salvador does not appear to meet those levels, partly because the 1911 treaty we have with El Salvador is not considered to be legally sufficient at this moment. And also, I think significantly enough, because none of the people that Trump seems to be envisioning have committed any crimes in El Salvador. The purpose of extradition is to allow somebody to be tried in another country. In the audio earlier, Trump is describing people who have committed crimes solely in the United States. So I don't think that's a viable pathway for anything that Trump is envisioning here.
I suppose one way around the constitutional protection for U.S. citizens is to take away that citizenship, to denaturalize them. You have found examples of the government trying this in the past.
Sure. And up until about the 1960s, it wasn't axiomatic that citizenship was irrevocable. There was a case in 1922 where a group of Chinese Americans went overseas, returned to the United States. They were denied reentry. And the Supreme Court ruled that they had a right to have a tribunal, a hearing, where they could prove that they were citizens, the premise being that if they were citizens, they couldn't be denied reentry. We also know from a case in the 1950s where a man was stripped of his citizenship for draft dodging. He was then put through deportation proceedings. The court struck down that provision of the Immigration Nationality Act that denaturalized him. And they since said in the 1963 case of Froyen v. Rusk that citizenship is more or less irrevocable unless done voluntarily. The sole exception for that is for naturalized citizens who lie during the immigration process. But even then, the Supreme Court has set an extremely high threshold for that proceeding to be carried out.
And so what changed in the 1960s?
Well, it's part of the sort of the Warren Court's reforms, but it's also part of a general recognition of the value of American citizenship and the rights that come with it. You know, when the court speaks of citizenship, they speak of it as almost sacrosanct, as something that defines a person's place in the world, defines their ability to participate in a political community, defines their ability to have a home. And so I think that the idea that somebody could be exiled from the United States while being a U.S. citizen cuts against that in the deepest way possible.
This brings us to the question of whether the Trump administration won't do it anyway, even if sending U.S. citizens to El Salvador or somewhere else is clearly illegal, unconstitutional. I'm thinking of the case currently in the headlines of Kilmar Abrego Garcia being held in El Salvador. Multiple Trump administration officials have said he was sent there by mistake. He is not a U.S. citizen, but he had been granted protection from deportation by an immigration judge.
Right, and he has a right to due process that was not followed there. One of the reasons that I wanted to explore this question and write this piece was because when we talk about things that presidents do, it's important to set context about where that falls on a constitutional spectrum. Presidents do things every day that are perfectly lawful, perfectly constitutional, even if people disagree with them. Presidents from both parties have done things that are in a little more of a gray zone. Maybe they're reinterpreting authority. Maybe they are applying it in a new scenario. Maybe they are using law in a way Congress didn't intend. That's normal and to be expected. This is not one of those scenarios. This is a scenario where there is no, that I've been able to find, legal or constitutional basis for the idea that you would send someone outside their country of citizenship, outside their country of birth, their nationality, send them to a foreign country that will then hold them indefinitely and deny them the opportunity to return. I can't rule out the possibility that the Trump administration will do it anyways, but I think it's important to set the marker now that there doesn't appear to be any legal or constitutional basis for those actions.
Matt Ford, staff writer at The New Republic, talking about his new piece, Trump's Wildly Unconstitutional Plot to Banish U.S. Citizens to Gulags. Matt Ford, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hi.
How do you define gender? It's something that individuals, schools, and governments have struggled with. And today, Britain's Supreme Court weighed in with a ruling that has ramifications for transgender people there. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Cheers outside the court in London from some of the women who brought this case, just after hearing Supreme Court Justice Patrick Hodge read aloud a unanimous ruling.
The terms woman and sex in the Equality Act 2010 refer to a biological woman and biological sex.
The court issued an 88-page judgment that says, in part, quote, the concept of sex is binary. A person is either a woman or a man. Those cheers were from supporters of a gender-critical group called For Women Scotland, which sued the Scottish government back in 2018.
This has been a really, really long road.
Susan Smith is the group's co-founder. She challenged a 2018 law that requires women to occupy half of the seats on public sector boards in Scotland. And that includes transgender women if they have government-issued gender recognition certificates. But gender-critical feminists challenged that. They want quotas to be only for people born female. They lost in lower courts, but won today, and Smith spoke outside the courthouse.
The judges have said what we always believe to be the case, that women are protected by their biological sex.
This campaign was bankrolled in part by this country's most famous gender-critical feminist, Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who's been accused of transphobia and targeted with boycotts and lawsuits over her views on trans women. This ruling is seen as a blow to transgender rights at a time when similar legal challenges are underway in the United States.
This is a bit Trumpian, frankly. What this ruling suggests is we're not welcome, we're not wanted, and we can now be excluded.
Jane Fay is director of Trans Actual, a group that supports and defends trans people in the UK. She says people are trying to figure out the implications of this. Are their gender recognition certificates still valid? Will this lead to labour discrimination or worse?
There's no clarity, but what we are sure of is that there will be masses of misinformation on social media, and we will see people challenging people who are trans or who they believe to be trans. Sometimes violently.
In his comments to the court, Judge Hodge counseled against seeing this as a triumph for one side or another. He said UK law does still protect transgender people from discrimination. The British government welcomed today's ruling, saying it'll bring clarity for women and protect single-sex spaces. But another charity working with people in Scotland where this case originated put out a message to its members. Please look out for yourself and each other, it said. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Autism diagnoses in the U.S. are on the rise, but the reason as to why is at the center of a debate between Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and some independent scientists and advocates. Today, RFK Jr. declared that autism is a growing epidemic in the U.S., and that has some experts worried. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has been covering all of this and joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey there.
Hey, okay, so Secretary Kennedy is using this word epidemic to describe the rate at which children are being diagnosed with autism in this country, right? Why is he using that word, you think?
So Kennedy is citing a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and that analysis found that in 2022, one out of every 31 kids was diagnosed with autism by their eighth birthdays. Okay. And that's up from one out of every 36 2 years earlier. Let's listen to how Kennedy described these findings today during his first news conference and starting his job.
This is part of an unrelenting upward trend. Overall, autism is increasing in prevalence at an alarming rate. The epidemic is real.
Now, you know, I should point out that statement runs contrary to the CDC report itself and what many independent autism experts say.
Wait, it's contrary how?
So according to the CDC report and many experts, this increase is actually kind of good news. That's because the increase is probably largely due to doctors getting better at screening kids for autism and diagnosing them earlier. That enables the kids to start getting the support they need. And it's not because the brain disorder is actually on the rise in any big way. Here's Dr. Sarah Swoboda from the American Academy of Pediatrics.
This is not an epidemic. This is just us doing a better job of identifying autistic children that have existed before. We have gotten so much better at recognizing and identifying autism in children. We're doing it sooner and earlier.
So Boda and others argue that while autism is a serious problem that should be addressed, calling autism an epidemic is both misleading and stigmatizing. I talked about this with Zoe Gross from the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. She has autism.
To say something is an epidemic implies that it's contagious, first of all, that it's like spreading from person to person, growing exponentially, that it's dangerous, that we should be panicking about it. Saying that autism destroys families, destroys children, the things he's saying really, they increase the stigma of autism and they make life more difficult for autistic people.
But during today's briefing, Kennedy dismissed the argument that the increase is due to better diagnoses, and instead he argued that autism is a preventable disease caused by some kind of what he called environmental toxin.
This is coming from an environmental toxin, and somebody made a profit by putting that environmental toxin into our air, our water, our medicines, our food.
Wait, did Kennedy say what kind of environmental toxin he thinks is at play here?
He didn't specify today, but in the past, Kennedy has linked childhood vaccines to autism. And now I should point out that any link between vaccines and autism has been debunked. Most experts think autism is probably caused by a complicated interaction of many factors, including, you know, probably some kind of genetic predisposition. But Kennedy disagrees with that and is launching a big new research project to identify the cause by September.
That is NPR's Rob Stein. Thank you, Rob.
Sure thing.
From the 16th to the 19th centuries, the Kingdom of Kabu dominated a swath of West Africa that included modern-day Guinea-Bissau. The stories of its royalty and reign have been told for generations through a kind of traditional song, one that helped inspire an archaeological dig that revealed physical evidence of the kingdom's capital. Here's reporter Ari Daniel.
Kabu emerged in the 13th century as a coastal province within the Kingdom of Mali in West Africa. But when Mali fell a few hundred years later, Kabu became independent. It grew wealthy from trade, including the slave trade, and dominated the region.
It played a key role in many events of historical importance for the world, including early African statehood, and it survives all the way till the late 19th century.
When Kabu was attacked by its southern neighbors, says Sirio Canos Denai. She's an archaeologist at the University of Valencia. The story goes that once the king saw the enemy army nearing the capital of Kansala, he set fire to the gunpowder house and blew up the city. That was the end of Kabu.
That's what European powers use, that void to encroach upon the territory and start controlling things. It's perceived as the end of independent African kingdoms before colonialism.
Much of what we know about Kabu has been passed down by a group of oral historians and musicians known as the griots. Nino Galisa lives in Guinea-Bissau and is a descendant of the first griots of Kabu.
We are, above all, the guardians of history. Our role is to interpret and preserve the history of our people of Kabu.
This is the kora, the instrument that griots use to sing about that history.
This instrument is a part of our life. It's spiritual, it's entertaining, it's imaginative, it's a companion.
Galisa has sung stories about Kabu and its capital, Kansala, for decades. But to him, it's the stuff of legend.
To me, it was a kind of fiction, like a story.
This perception that maybe it's an imaginary place, it's sort of a Camelot.
Sirio Canos Denai has led multiple archaeological digs of Kabu in present-day Senegal, but never in Guinea-Bissau, where the capital of Kansala was once located. And to really understand the kingdom and its downfall, she knew she had to excavate it.
We don't proceed with excavations without the explicit consent of the local communities, and they were very receptive.
So in early 2024, she and her colleagues began the work of unearthing Kansala, which allowed them to sketch out a map of the site, nearly 150 acres.
Which is absolutely enormous.
They found fortresses, evidence of extensive trade, and the gunpowder house that was likely detonated centuries ago. Physical validation of the people and places coursing through the songs of the griots passed down over generations. Nino Galisa was deeply moved.
When you arrive at a place that people have spoken about your whole life and the characters we've sung about, and suddenly you find people that tell you, yes, this is where these folks actually sat, it's like you're really seeing it.
Once the excavation concluded, the archaeologists gave Galisa a copy of the report. They asked if he might transform their findings into song as a way of sharing the work with the community. Galisa accepted. In his song, Galisa describes some of the findings of the dig. He also wrote lyrics about the aspect of all this that touched him so, that what the griots sing about is real.
I stressed that archaeologists returned to us a sense of pride, that people can now truly understand the role of griots as historians.
Galisa says the archaeology revealed to him that he and his fellow singers are like libraries, a living record of their community's royal legacy. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
President Trump doesn't want to stop at sending migrants to prison in El Salvador. He says he wants to send U.S. citizens too. Critics say that's wrong.
There are profound ethical questions that this would signal about how we treat human beings who are U.S. citizens.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, a group of military veterans meet over beer to try to bridge political divides.
They call the gatherings Pints and Patriotism.
I think it's helpful to have veterans in the room because we don't start a conversation with who cares more about America. It's just sort of assumed.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. California has filed another lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's tariff policies, claiming they're ruining the lives of farmers and business people in the state. Governor Gavin Newsom was surrounded by almond farmers in California's Central Valley today who say their lives are being upended by the tariffs battle with China. Newsom says the nation's agriculture will be disproportionately affected by these tariffs.
Almonds you see around us, export dependent. Pistachios, export dependent. Dairy, export dependent. In fact, 43% of almonds and pistachios and dairy are export dependent.
California's Central Valley supplies a large portion of the country's fruits, nuts, and veggies. Governor Newsom says he's now trying to make deals with Mexico and Canada to exempt California-made goods from being taxed. Tech stocks drove Wall Street to another sell-off this afternoon after chip company NVIDIA issued a warning about the cost of President Trump's trade war with China. Here's NPR's Maria Aspen.
NVIDIA is the third largest U.S. company by market value, thanks to its booming business of supplying the chips for artificial intelligence processors. But now, President Trump is imposing new restrictions on how chip companies export their products, especially to China. NVIDIA warned investors that these new rules will cost it $5.5 billion, while rival AMD also said it's bracing for financial pain. Shares of both companies plunged. More broadly, investors were also Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who warned that the central bank could face a, quote, challenging scenario in trying to safeguard the U.S. economy from the impact of Trump's wide-ranging tariffs. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Stocks fell across the board on Wall Street. You're listening to NPR News. Two Marines from Camp Pendleton deployed to the southern border died in a vehicle accident. Authorities say a third suffered critical injuries on the way to El Paso. They were deployed as part of a joint task force overseeing President Trump's border security initiatives. From member station KTEP, Angela Corcherga reports.
The three Marines were traveling on a two-lane highway in southern New Mexico Tuesday morning. They were driving to El Paso. According to a statement from Joint Task Force Southern Border, two service members were killed in the accident and a third is in critical condition at an area hospital. Their names have not been released. These are the first deaths since the Trump administration deployed an additional 10,000 troops to the border this year. The cause of the accident is under investigation. For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
After weeks of back and forth, a federal judge has found probable cause to hold the Trump administration in contempt for violating his deportation order last month. The government used the Alien Enemies Act to send flights of alleged gang members to El Salvador with no due process. The Trump administration plans to appeal. The judge warned he could refer the case for prosecution. On Wall Street, stocks down across the board today. The tech-heavy NASDAQ lost more than 500 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments,
As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Trump administration, quote, demonstrated willful disregard for a court's order and is likely in criminal contempt. That is what U.S. District Judge James Boasberg ruled today here in Washington. Boasberg has been trying to determine if the government purposely ignored him last month when he told it to turn back two airplanes, planes carrying Venezuelan migrants, to a prison in El Salvador. NPR's Adrian Florido is here. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Mary Louise.
What else did Judge Boasberg say in his ruling?
Well, he said that he found that, in fact, government officials did ignore his order to turn those planes around. A little context, Mary Louise. On March 15th, President Trump announced that he'd invoked the Wartime Alien Enemies Act of 1798 so he could quickly deport members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua without hearings. Later that day, officials in Texas loaded dozens of men into two airplanes. The ACLU got wind of the government's plans and sued. During an emergency hearing, in D.C. that evening, Judge Boasberg asked government lawyers if the planes had already taken off and said if they had, they needed to turn around. The planes did not turn back, though. They landed in El Salvador, and that country's president locked the men up. Boasberg, in his ruling today, said the government could have returned those planes because they took off during his hearing, and they landed after he'd issued his order. He wrote that, and I'm quoting here, "The Constitution does not tolerate willful disobedience of judicial orders." And he said that he had probable cause to find the administration in criminal contempt.
Criminal contempt. So what does that mean when that's applied to the federal government?
Well, it depends on what the government does next. Boasberg gave it until next Wednesday to do one of two things. It can show him how it's working to correct its violation. And he said that the most obvious way would be to reassert custody of the men it deported so they can challenge their deportations in federal courts. They are still being held in that Salvadoran prison, and many of their families have flatly denied that they are gang members. If the government chooses not to do that, Boasberg said, then he said it needs to tell him the names of the specific government officials who ignored his order. He said he will hold contempt hearings and, if necessary, appoint a lawyer to criminally prosecute them for contempt, and they could face fines or prison.
So how are both sides responding to this ruling? Start with the lawyers who brought this case.
Well, they're from the ACLU and from a group called Democracy Forward. This is Democracy Forward's attorney in this case, Sky Perriman.
This ruling, it's clear that we've seen the government has acted in blatant disregard for the judiciary, treating court orders as if they are optional. And that's not how our systems of checks and balances works. This really is something that should concern every single person in the country.
She said that her team will continue working through the courts to ensure that everyone in the U.S. gets due process. On the other side, a White House spokesman said the government will appeal today's ruling. He said the president is committed to ensuring that, quote, criminal illegal migrants are no longer a threat to Americans. The Department of Justice also issued a statement calling Boasberg's ruling a judicial power grab.
Adrian, this is, of course, not the only case in which federal courts are trying to force the Trump administration to obey court orders. Zoom out. Give us the bigger picture.
Well, members of the Trump administration have said they're not going to let courts get in their way of carrying out the president's priorities. And today is the first time a judge has clearly said they will be punished for not obeying courts. If they still refuse, that is where legal experts say that we will have a full-blown constitutional crisis where the balance of powers between the executive and judicial branches may not hold.
NPR's Adrian Florido, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
The Boston Marathon is happening on Monday, and this year, the event is marking the anniversary of an important tradition. From member station GBH, Craig LaMolt reports that 50 years ago, Boston became the first major marathon to include a division for wheelchair athletes.
Jason Fowler directs his racing wheelchair out of his parents' driveway in Kingston, Massachusetts.
Yeah, let's do it.
And out onto the quiet neighborhood streets. He's low to the ground, and his chair looks aerodynamic as I ride alongside on a bike.
Everybody always thinks that we're grabbing the wheel or the hand rim.
But as he speeds down the road, he's actually propelling himself forward by hitting each wheel with a gloved hand.
As you can imagine, just like your feet get sore from running, our knuckles and hands get really sore from punching the hand rim after a couple hours.
The power of each push forward comes from his upper back and shoulders. He's paralyzed from the bottom of his rib cage down, so he doesn't have abs to help move him forward. Fowler lives in busy South Boston, where there's a lot more to dodge, so he likes to come out here to his parents' place to train.
And this back road, there's just no cars, which is glorious for a wheelchair racer.
But he does sometimes get chased by dogs. Fowler's out here getting ready for the Boston Marathon, a spring event that cruelly requires competitors, whether on sneakers or wheels, to train through the winter.
So navigating snow and ice and even sand, it just makes it really unsafe. Not to mention, like, the chances you're gonna get a flat go up about 10 times.
But he does it anyway, because he loves it. Growing up, Fowler was a competitive motocross racer, and he broke his back when he was 17.
6 months after my accident, I borrowed a racing wheelchair from a friend of a friend and started doing road races.
At 18 years old, he competed in his first Boston Marathon, finishing in an hour and 55 minutes, and he hasn't stopped since. He's competed in about 50 marathons and even more triathlons, winning 2 Ironman World Championships. And this year, at age 51, Fowler will race in his 21st Boston Marathon. It's a special one, he says, because it's the 50th anniversary of the first wheelchair athlete to compete in the Boston Marathon.
I always thought I had the ability to do what I set my mind out to, what no matter what distance.
That's Bob Hall, who was the first to do it in 1975.
I wasn't always good or wasn't always winning, but it was always about the challenge.
It wasn't Hall's idea to compete in Boston. He heard some other wheelchair athletes talking about maybe doing his hometown marathon, and a mixture of pride and competitiveness took over.
If I didn't do it, someone, you know, would have shown up and did it, and that would have been like catastrophe for me.
The Boston Marathon's race director agreed to award Hall a certificate of completion if he could finish in under 3 hours.
I never thought about what I was doing as first or unique, or I was really doing it for myself. I never even thought about the time. It was a ride of enjoyment.
Even so, Hall beat that 3-hour goal by 2 minutes. And he was using a clunky hospital-style wheelchair, unlike the racing ones used today. Boston became the first major marathon to include a wheelchair division. And since that first race, a half century ago, nearly 1,900 wheelchair athletes have competed. Among them is Jason Fowler.
I say competing is in my blood, but for the most part, it just makes me a better human. It used to be about winning and competition. And now I realize how fortunate I am to be healthy enough to do these things.
On Monday, Fowler will be among 50 wheelchair athletes using every bit of strength they have to make it 26.2 grueling miles to the finish line of the Boston Marathon. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Boston.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Nearly 7 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. If you are one of their caregivers, you're probably exhausted. So it can be tempting to put your loved one in front of the TV when you need a break. But regular programming does not always work well. Vermont Public's Nina Keck tells us about 2 video streaming services specifically designed for people with dementia and their caregivers.
Allison Schreier says her husband was diagnosed with frontal lobe dementia when he was just 47.
As a family caregiver, like I lived, as many family caregivers do, in fear.
Fear of when he would become agitated or upset, and fear about her own well-being as a caregiver with 2 young children. As her husband's condition worsened, she also grew increasingly frustrated trying to find things they could do together. So she started creating videos for him on her iPad.
and that we could talk about what we were seeing. I could pause them and we could talk about them in more detail. There was music in the background and I thought, well, yeah.
It was an aha moment that took several years to research and develop. But in 2022, Schreier co-founded Zinnia TV. Think Netflix or Hulu, but with hundreds of slow-paced, plot-free videos, like this one called Hawaiian Breeze. There are no confusing characters to keep track of and no jarring commercials, just eye-popping footage of exotic birds, flowers, beaches, and waterfalls. There's a 10-minute video called Let's Talk About Picnics, others about undersea creatures, national parks, and babies. Lots of babies.
And the idea is that we want people to be able to pause and reminisce and say, wow, I remember that.
Memory Lane TV is another streaming service for people with dementia. It's got an even larger selection of videos.
The films are shot in ultra high definition, and it's very captivating visually.
Nick Vitti is an occupational therapist at the Cedars, a senior living community in Portland, Maine.
We have residents that aren't able to engage easily in a lot of things. They are engaged by Memory Lane TV, as is frequently the staff who stop in and will watch for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. You know, it's very calming.
That can be helpful towards evening when it's common for people with dementia to become confused or anxious. Zinnia TV has a daily activities channel that Schreier says can help encourage things like drinking water, brushing teeth, and washing.
If we're going to shower to get ready for the day, I can just show the shower video and say, look at these people, what are they doing? Wow, that water looks so warm and comfortable. Ooh, maybe we should shower. That might be a good idea.
Memory Lane TV recently launched a partnership with LA Alzheimer's to stream the California nonprofit's multilingual and multicultural caregiver support videos. Subscriptions start around $8 to $10 a month. Tammy Bickmore is an assistant clinical professor in occupational therapy at the University of Southern Maine.
These products have a lot of potential good, right? But you can't just turn it on and think it's going to fix everything.
She says dementia affects people differently, and what works for one person may not work with someone else. But she and other experts interviewed for this story say the more tools and support caregivers have, the better. For NPR News, I'm Nina Kack.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. During the heat of the presidential campaign, a veterans group started holding public meetings, usually at brew pubs. The idea was make a space for a civil conversation across partisan lines. They called the events Pints and Patriotism. Well, the meetings went pretty well, but the need has not gone away, so the group is holding more. NPR's Quill Lawrence dropped in for a beer.
Outside Portland, Maine, about 60 people fill the bar at the Definitive Brewing Company. Most of them are veterans or family.
Good evening, everyone. Oh, I'm sorry. That's really loud.
Allison Jaslow directs Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and she's co-hosting the event.
I was joking that veterans are the referees that America needs right now, too. I think it's helpful to have veterans in the room because we don't start a conversation with who cares more about America. It's just sort of assumed.
Her co-host is Jordan Wood with a group called Democracy First. He lays out what he says are four nonpartisan rules to keep a democracy healthy.
They are the right to vote for eligible citizens, denouncing political violence against your opponents, stopping the spread of misinformation about our elections, and accepting the outcome of elections and supporting the peaceful transfer of power.
So that's it. Then they just start passing the mic.
Oh, hi. I've served 81 to 83, but my concern is directly to the point of how we can fight against the teardown of the VA.
There are comments about how to limit cuts in VA care, and most of the crowd has a pretty good opinion of VA care, and a question about the number of female military leaders getting fired.
And as a woman in the military, I'm curious about your thoughts on the recent backsliding in women in leadership roles.
Another topic that keeps coming up was the recent controversy about the Secretary of Defense sharing airstrike plans on the Signal app.
This is no laughing matter. This is no minor thing. I mean, it really infuriates me. Some enlisted guy screws up with a secret document. Bye-bye. You're gone.
Now, this crowd may be a bit self-selected. People who support the way things are going might not feel the need to come out and air their complaints. One man quietly leaves after asking his question or two. I caught up with him real quick outside.
I heard enough. I've got nothing but respect for the military.
His name is Cody Gillis, and he didn't serve, but his son is in the Navy. Gillis thinks the crowd was left-leaning. He wanted to discuss issues of anti-Semitism at colleges, the vandalism of Teslas. He thinks the media has overblown the leak of the airstrike details on Signal.
Signalgate. If you listen to something other than the legacy media, you'd know there was nothing. They say, it was war plans. It wasn't.
Gillis also says he thinks inside agitators helped ramp up the January 6th riots at the Capitol. Which brings us to a subject being discussed back in the bar. What is a fact, even, anymore?
Joel Lehman here, and I served from 66 to 69.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. He's a Vietnam-era vet. He gets a round of applause off the bat. But this is his point.
I see our country with two separate truths. I have Republican and Democrat friends that can't talk to each other.
And that strikes a chord with people. Some say they think the media wants society divided because it's good for ratings. Some others suggest contacting Maine's members of Congress to keep vets' issues front of mind. Another fellow takes the mic. He says democracy is messy, but there's always a chance to hold people accountable next election. Jeff Edelstein is his name. He's not a veteran, but he swears like one. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how many of you know the quote from Churchill. He said, democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else that has been tried.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it, it sucks. Democracy is tough, but it is the best thing.
I not only agree with you, I don't need Winston Churchill quotes to give me that hope. I mean, rooms like this give me hope.
Yeah.
That's Iraq veteran Allison Jaslow chiming in there, but her co-host of the event, Jordan Wood, has a last word or two.
I would just add, though, that we can't let democracy protect itself. It needs us to defend it, and it takes citizens to say we want to we want to preserve this. We want to stand up for it.
And despite the somber topics, just coming out and talking seems to have helped.
Thank you all for joining us this
evening.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Portland, Maine.
A colossal squid has been captured on camera in its natural habitat for the first time, 100 years after the discovery of the species. And this one's a baby. NPR's Ayana Archie has more.
Colossal squids are elusive creatures that live exclusively in the deep sea near Antarctica. They're the heaviest known invertebrates, and they can be massive, reaching lengths of 23 feet and weighing at least 1,100 pounds. But this past March, a remotely operated underwater vehicle captured footage of a colossal squid that was, well, not so colossal. It was a baby, roughly a foot long, nearly 2,000 feet below the surface of the South Atlantic Ocean. Dr. Kat Bolstad is an associate professor at the Auckland University of Technology in New Zealand. She helped verify the footage, which was taken by a crew from the Schmidt Ocean Institute, a research nonprofit. She said in a press conference on Tuesday that colossal squids have likely not been caught on camera until now because they are very sensitive to their environments.
That, of course, means that when we put large, noisy, bright technology down to try to see these animals and other things in the deep sea, they will know that we are there long before we know that they are there.
Tom Lindley, who helps develop technology to explore the deep sea, was aboard the ship with the team capturing the footage when he caught a glimpse of the baby squid in the corner of his eye. Lindley snapped an iPhone photo of what he saw and sent it to Bolstad. But a fuzzy phone picture wasn't quite enough to identify the colossal squid.
Now I could message Kat and just say, like, from what you've told me, this looks important. And that was just me taking a photo of the screen with my phone, which apparently was incredibly cruel on the other end because she's climbing the walls like, give me the high res, give me the high res.
Bolstad and Dr. Aaron Evans, another squid expert on the Schmidt crew, were able to make out key attributes of the colossal squid. 8 arms and 2 tentacles with hooks. Its body was transparent with pearly eyes and organs. That's typical for members of its family, known informally as glass squids. As it matures, it will likely become more opaque as its muscles thicken. Because of colossal squid's evasive nature, researchers still don't know much about their diet, lifespan, or reproductive traits. Much of what they do know has been inferred from their observations about similar species, Bolstad said. But with this new footage, scientists can better understand these massive squids, even when they're pretty little. Ayana Archie, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Now here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red-hot hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest rail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a hail.